When you need to do more with less, Upwork helps you hire fast without the overhead. Find expert freelancers in design, marketing, IT, AI, and more. Never tried Upwork? Now's the perfect time. Spend your first $1,000 and get $200 in credit for your next project. No upfront costs. No long-term commitments. Just $200 to reinvest in what matters. Go to Upwork.com/save to get started. That's UPWORK.com/SAVE. Upwork.com/save.
What up, what up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. It is good to be back in the house with you as we sort of sail into the holiday season. We're really glad you could spend some time with us, as always. You know, I love
it. Delighted to be here.
I got my brother with me from another mother. Rick Wilson is in the house today. We're so excited to have Rick be a part of the conversation. You guys know him. You love him. He is without a doubt one of the strongest, most compelling voices out there today about democracy and what our country is and certainly what it isn't. And why we have responsibilities to each other in that regard. He is a longtime Republican political strategist, infamous negative ad maker and commentator, which I love. And y'all, let's just be straight up. Y'all love those negative ads, so don't even sit there and pretend you don't, okay? Don't start acting like little bitches in the corner. Oh my God, I can't believe they put that on the air. Y'all sitting there laughing your asses off going, you're right. We understand how it works, right? We know. He's published in the Washington Post, Politico, The Hill, The London Spectator, Rolling Stones, The New York Daily News, USA Today, The Bulwark. He is a man about town in all matters and a frequent guest with my buddy, Bill Maher. He is none other than Rick Wilson.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm good, bro. I'm really good. And good. I do want to mention your book. You've written a lot of books. The latest, Everything Trump Touches Dies, number one New York Times bestseller that defined the Trump era. And I want to start there with you. And then I want to go back a little bit in time because I don't know if you had a chance to read Davis Brooks's piece in The Atlantic, which I'm just blown away by just the in-depth nature in which he's written about conservatism, and it's entitled Conservatism and Elegy. And we'll get into that, but I want to start with how you looked at this period that's even, yes, encapsulated in Trump, but there was really in your writing, not just about what was happening in the Trump era in terms of what Trump was doing, but then more subtly what that was saying about a broader narrative in the American story. How do you assess all of that at this point?
Yeah, I mean, Mike, I know we've talked about this a little bit before, Michael. Trump is in some ways symptomatic of a broader collapse of free market, individual liberty, conservatism that was creeping in the door as early as 2008. When the Tea Party rolled in, it should have sounded some louder alarm bells that it was becoming, that Republicanism was not definitionally conservatism any longer. But it was definitionally this cultural opposition and this sense of aggrievement and this sense of being under attack all the time.
Can I pause you right there? Because you just said something that I think is so important for people to understand. You just made the point that Republicanism was no longer definitionally conservatism. Yep. Because a lot of people get all of that twisted up and wrapped up as one and the same. And I keep telling people conservatism is something that Republicanism embraces in many respects, because not every Republican is conservative and not every conservative is a Republican.
Correct.
But you make an important point. I don't want people to lose sight of that as we have this conversation, because I think it's important to understand what it is and what it isn't relative to the political party, Republicanism.
Mm-hmm. It really has become a party that is nationalist and populist and statist in a lot of ways. When you hear people like J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio and Josh Hawley saying that if companies aren't ideologically aligned with us, we should use the power of the state to punish them. I'm sorry, Michael. I grew up, you know, I'm just an old dumbass philosophy major who read Kirk and Burke and Hayek and right. Buckley and all those things coming up. And I missed the part about punishing your enemies with the power of the state as a central tenet of conservatism. Call me crazy. Maybe it's in there somewhere. I just missed it because
it didn't show up in my neighborhood.
As a very dark idea. And we're seeing that more and more. And it's become purely about this sense of cultural outrage, this sense of, again, the sense of aggrievement and entitlement, and this idea that, oh, everyone's out to get us, therefore everything is acceptable. And again, I don't think that's a conservative philosophy. You know, I don't think that a lot of the things that Republican governors and legislatures are doing now represents a conservative philosophy. They are expanding the power of government, expanding the power of the state, expanding the use of executive orders, and it gets broader and broader, and it gets darker and darker all the time. And you know, if the shoe were on the other foot, if the jackboot were on the other foot, if you will,
yep,
these people would be losing their goddamn minds.
Every fucking moment they would be losing.
You know, I, as an example, I gave somebody the other day. If California tomorrow adopted the same thing that Texas did on abortion, but for guns, and they said, we're going to reward you for snitching on people who have guns in California. We're going to reward you if you find somebody has a 30-round standard capacity magazine for their AR-15 instead of a 10-round magazine. We're going to reward you and give you money for that. Republicans would be losing their they would be like the hemorrhage would be, it'd be like a cloud of red goo flying out of their brains every day because they would lose their damn minds. That is a weird application of state power, and but it's not the only one. You know, reducing the voting stuff, the voting rights across the country, breaking local governments. In Florida, you've got Ron DeSantis who's telling private companies and local governments that they can't screen for people for COVID vaccination.
Right.
I mean, stop
and think about that. The governor of the damn state is telling people, we don't want you to do anything. We won't allow you to do anything that will protect the people in the community by screening for those who may be sick, for screening for those who may be unvaccinated. Right. Not to prosecute or persecute the people unvaccinated, but just to protect everybody else. Right. And he's like, no. If you do that, we're gonna lock you up. We're gonna fine you.
Yeah.
And it does speak, I think, a great deal to how Republicanism and conservatism, you know, while they were apart but together, right? They kind of work together, have now become this sort of contorted, sort of despotic kind of narrative around centralized government control, ironically enough, to your point about how they want to use government. And it really struck a chord with me in reading David Brooks' piece in The Atlantic. Yeah. And I want to bring that in because I think it'll help us set up the rest of our conversation. He starts out by, you know, as you talked about some of the core philosophies and ideas, he said, you know, one of the core conservative principles, you know, revolves around this epistemological modesty.
Epistemological
modesty.
Philosophy major.
I had a drink today and I can't speak worse shit. I don't understand. Or humility in the face of what we don't know about a complex world and a conviction that social change should be steady but cautious and incremental. Conservatives put a lot of faith in the latent wisdom that is passed down by generations, cultures, families, and institutions. And that shows up as a set of quick and ready institutions about what to do in any situation. the most important sentiments are moral sentiments. Conservatism certainly has an acute awareness of sin, selfishness, greed, lust, but conservatives also believe that in the right circumstances, people are motivated by the positive moral emotions, especially sympathy and benevolence, but also at admiration, patriotism, charity, and loyalty. Those last pieces, which right. David sets out is foundational to conservatism, were seemingly the first things, Rick, that were jettisoned in this Trump era.
That's right. Yeah, look, the convenience of quickly motivated political passions is an addictive thing. And we, you know, you and I felt it because we were dealing with the radioactive material of the Tea Party 12 years ago,
right.
Knowing how powerful it was on one hand and motivating, but how quickly it could descend into something darker. And with Trumpism, you saw that same convenient sugar rush of being able to mobilize the base to a level it had never been mobilized before. But that also made them as a party start to break away from the things that we used to say matter: the Constitution, the rule of law, individual freedom and liberty, the restricted power of governance. And all of those things were traded so quickly. They were traded so easily. And people you and I have known for years and years and years, who you would have described as rock-ribbed, absolute hardcore conservatives on whatever issue, whether it was social conservatism or economic conservatism or foreign policy conservatism, in order to keep their place in the Washington, D.C. food chain, they jumped right in and said, yeah, screw it, whatever he wants, whatever Trump wants. And that's what the party became, and that's what Republicanism became. And today there's this infrastructure around it that didn't exist before of this sort of American neo-populism and this racially in the best case scenario, they are very aware of how they can exploit race. In the worst case scenario, they are blood and soil white mats.
Right.
And for all that those things, you know, individually would be problematic, you know, the sudden reliance on executive orders all the time. That would have been problematic for conservatives when it was Obama doing it. I screamed about it. You screamed about it. All of our friends were like, how dare he try to govern through executive orders?
Right.
Well, with Trump, it was like, executive orders are the natural divine right of kings. Why shouldn't he?
Why shouldn't he? Right. Right.
You know?
So it goes to, you know, in one final piece on the Brooks article, and you've touched on it in your response, the answer to the questions that he poses about today's conservatism. And he starts this portion of it saying American conservatism has always been in tension with itself. And that's very true.
Sure.
You even go back.
No doubt.
He references, the ugly period that we saw with William F. Buckley, where he was full on racist, at least segregationist in his views.
Yep.
And yet, you know, he had to sort of learn and grow out of that. But he goes on and he talks about Donald Trump is the near opposite of the Burkean conservatism he refers to in this article. How did a movement built on sympathy and wisdom lead to a man who possesses neither? How did a movement that puts such importance on the moral formation of the individual end up elevating an unabashed moral degenerate? How did a movement built on an image of society as a complex organism give rise to the simplistic dichotomies of manipulative populism? How did a movement based on respect for the wisdom of the past end up with Trump's authoritarian campaign boast, I alone affix it, perhaps the least conservative sentence it is ever possible to utter? Those questions for me are questions that you and I have gotten in so many ways and so many different forms over the last 5 or 6 years.
For sure.
And it really kind of goes to the heart of what you were saying and the heart of what Lincoln Project, the work you guys have done there, have tried to expose people to, sometimes humorously, sometimes a lot more seriously, but all times accurately, to begin to answer some of these questions that this movement has become self-absorbed into something else, as opposed to adhering to those Burkean conservative principles that were the root of its founding.
There is an idea that you can substitute victory for everything, and that if you just get to the goal line, all the methodologies, all the diversions from what you claim you believe are justified and acceptable. And, you know, I've written about this in my second book. I wrote about this, I think by both books I mentioned this, but the irony of where we are right now is that the people who apparently were the actual true believers were the jaded, political, cynical hacks like us.
Right.
And not all the people who claim this aura of moral superiority on whatever their issue was. You know, there was a time when guys like Matt Schlapp were like, oh no, Mitt Romney's a dangerous liberal.
I know.
Can't have him. Right. And now, you know, these people have adopted, it shows in a way the fragility of a conservatism that is mediated by celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And Republicans were always looking for, because part of this is that sense of cultural inferiority.
Mm-hmm.
They were always like, oh, such and such movie star is a Republican. He's a conservative. We got to rally around this woman or that guy. And that was a very powerful desire, because they feel culturally inferior in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And as that infected them, when they finally got a celebrity of their own, Donald Trump, even though he was a D-grade reality show shill, it turned them into these almost hypnotized creatures where they're like, everything's fine. Everything's fine. No matter what, now we have a winner. We're going to win all the time. And he knew that. He knew how to pitch them on that. Because American politics is not a static thing. It's a constant sort of homeostatic tension between the two extremes. No conservative has ever been in too much power for too long. We've never held every bit of government for, you know, a generation. No Democratic, you know, situation has ever been in so much power, maybe since FDR, and that's a sort of outlier because there's a war going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever gets their way completely. Nobody ever gets the whole cake. And that's okay, or it should be. And for years, conservatism talked about the power of ideas and markets will drive us to the goal line eventually. And it turned out they didn't really care about ideas or markets. They cared about the raw acquisition of power and a cultural dominance and when you finally ended up with this confluence of the collapse of the industrial economy,
mm-hmm.
the graying of America, the rise of social media, the rise of Fox News as a singular mediating force in Republican politics, the confluence of all those things made it perfectly ripe for Donald Trump to come along. Now, we would have gotten, I think, to the point of a Trump candidate.
Right.
Maybe in 2020, maybe in 2024, it would have been somebody who embraced all the ugly stuff that those things entail. But it didn't. But Trump drove it beyond that because people saw him on reality TV for 15 years. They believed what they saw.
So you set it up very nicely in terms of where this thing called conservatism has devolved itself into this muddled mass. I keep trying to tell people that this is not conservative. It's not what drew me as a young 17-year-old kid growing up in D.C. into the party. It was, sort of my studies of, you know, Burke, but also my experience with real live conservatives, such as they existed in D.C. at the time, but a Republican Party that was anchored around some core values and ideas about how to govern a nation. And it really brought it home for me in Dan Crenshaw's speech of truth this week, where He just put it, you know, it was at an event in Texas, Republican, a congressman from Texas. And he said that the current GOP is a pariah. And it's become a place where working in Congress, he said, quote, "You heard online that 80 Republicans voted to track you in a vaccine database. If it sounds too ridiculous to be true, it's probably not true." And he goes on and he sort of gives these examples like that of where this party has gotten off the rails, and basically said, at the end of the day, you know, I'm working and serving with a bunch of grifters and performance artists, to your point. That's what conservatism has become. So if it is all of these things that do not elevate the Burkean model or the model of conservative governance of a Teddy Roosevelt or a Dwight Eisenhower, mm-hmm. a Ronald Reagan, or even a Mitt Romney, if you will, what is it then? What does it look like for us going forward? How does that set up what comes next in 2022 and 2024?
Right. There's a lot of terrible news here. The incentive structure of the Republican Party used to be you were pursuing the good of the nation. Then it devolved down to we're going to do well politically while doing good. Now it's devolved down to what Reed Galen and I call the hamster wheel. Mm-hmm. The hamster wheel is a Republican goes out and says something completely outrageous and stupid because they know outrageous and stupid things will draw press attention. The media and everyone else in the world goes, "Oh my God, can you believe what that jackass just said? Fuck Matt Gaetz." Then Matt Gaetz runs to Fox and says, "I'm being oppressed and they're after me and they're going to try to, and they, if you don't save me, then nothing." He gets a hit on Fox, on Hannity or Laura or wherever. Right. And then the minute that ends, he puts out an email for fundraising that says, "Can you believe what I just had to tell Sean Hannity about these evil Republicans or evil Democrats attacking me?" And the hamster wheel spins again and again. When they want more money, they go back to something else ridiculous. Thomas Massey and posing with his family with guns, right?
Right.
That's a trolling effort. He's going to, I promise you, if he hasn't already, he will. He's going to put out a fundraising email that says, "Can you believe they're attacking my family?" For,
mm-hmm.
And so that's all that's left. And that incentive structure, there's sort of a Gresham's law of political stunts. The bad drives out good. And so they'll get more and more egregious. Matt Gaetz is out there saying, "I'm going to name Donald Trump as Speaker of the House." He might,
right.
But he's doing that to piss people off and get in the news and get people to talk about him and get people to bring him onto TV shows where he can yell about how oppressed he's being by the horrible liberal elites and raise money off of it. And that's what's left of the rank and file. A lot of them also live in fear.
Yeah.
They are afraid of the mob. And conservatism, stretching back to the Burkean analysis of the French Revolution, was about not having the mob dominate political life.
That's right.
It was about not having the mob as the central power structure of your party. But the mob is the power structure of the Republican Party now. The mob feeds on the sense of threat and of menace that they bring against Republican politicians. I wrote about this in my first book. A Republican congressman who was a good friend of mine in Michigan, November of 17 or 16, he endorses Trump at the last minute. He doesn't love the guy at all. Mm-hmm. He endorses him at the last minute, holds his nose. He was a Jeb guy, a Marco guy, a Ted guy. You know, everybody but Trump finally endorsed him. It was a moderate district. But first town hall meeting in January of 17, guy in a red hat stands up and goes, "Are you going to be with Mr. Trump 100% of the time?" He's like, "Well, I'd like to support Donald Trump. I hope that Paul Ryan and Donald Trump can work together. We'll have a conservative." Da, da, da. Guy stands up again. "I asked you if you were going to be with Mr. Trump 100% of the time." And the congressman answers, "Look, if it's right for the district, I'm going to be with them 100% of the time. If it's wrong for you, the people I represent under the Constitution, I will oppose him." By the time he got off stage, his wife had texted him 911 about 15 times because the crazies had gone on their Facebook page and their kids' social media accounts and the school where their kids went to school and her employer and his employer. And it was death threats and it was obscene, just disgusting stuff. And, you know, somebody left a voicemail on his teenage kid's phone saying, "Hey, your dad better do what I do, better be with Mr. Trump or you won't have a dad." These people are fucking crazy. Yeah. They get away with it and they scare the shit out of the average member of Congress. And the fact that those people have never been sanctioned or punished has led them to more and more power.
So that's a key part for me, Rick, because I emphasize this when I appear on MSNBC and reluctantly fall into talking about Trump. I'm like, well, I don't know why we're still buying the talk about this asshole, but okay, fine. Since we're here, the reason why this permeates and continues to persist is that Trump knows there are no consequences for the bad behavior. His followers now know there's no consequences for the bad behavior. They're lionizing, you know, someone who storms the Capitol and in the course of committing an insurrection is killed, and everybody's like she's the martyr. You know, they lionize a 17-year-old kid who crosses, you know, state lines with a weapon he's not legally allowed to own, and kills two people and wounds a third, and everybody wants to, you know, give him a congressional medal. So there are no consequences for the bad behavior out there, which fuels the narrative.
Right, it is the perversion of the incentive structure of politics. You know, right now, you get rewarded for being the worst asshole in the room. You get rewarded for being cruel, and you get rewarded for being shitty, and you get rewarded for saying dumb stuff.
Right.
And this is why at the Lincoln Project and in my own sort of personal philosophy, I don't see a way back to the party you and I once knew.
Yeah.
I think there has to be a cataclysmic, you know, moment before that's going to work out again. And right now, because God bless our friends in the Democratic Party, they cannot organize a goddamn two-car motorcade. They cannot organize a rally around a fucking table at Waffle House.
No, they can't.
And it kills me.
Lord Jesus, they can't.
It kills me, Michael. Brother, I talk with these people and they're so well-intentioned. They're like, well, our climate change plan, that'll sell. I'm like, are you out of your goddamn mind? Shut the fuck up. None of your policy bullshit's going to sell. You couldn't sell it. It's like these people could not, they cannot realize that the Republican Party, they're going to say, oh, you have a 600-page climate plan? Let's send some nerds to look through it and pick out four things that scare the fuck out of grandma. Did you know the climate plan will mean old people will be eaten? And they're going to say shit like that, and it won't be true, but it'll work.
It'll work.
Politics is not about policy. It is about this giant nimbus, this giant cloud of social and cues, and this giant cloud of affect and personality and image, and it's just like you lose to the shittiest people on earth. How does that make you feel over time if you're the Democrats? Because you know they're like, we can't beat this asshole.
Folks, just so you know, Rick and I are both sitting here with our heads in our hands going, what the hell? Why can't these people? What the shit? So you've teed that up perfectly, Rick. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with the one and only Rick Wilson from the Lincoln Project. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more with Rick right after this.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news? Weird politics, weird country, Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, Available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking to the incomparable, the one and only Rick Wilson of the Lincoln Project, noted author, political guru. And we were just talking about just the juxtaposition of a Republican Party that is, it has gone full MAGA, full fascist, full, you know, white nativist, up against a Democratic Party that is sitting there having policy discussions about matters and issues that people could give a flying shit about.
Right.
And then wondering why nobody is signing up for, you know, their review of their 600-page thesis on why the climate is changing.
It is, you know, and I harp on this one because I am a guy who understands it better than 99.99% of Americans. You know, you go into, you look at Texas, and last month, about 180,000 people in Texas applied for a firearm, mm-hmm. like for a firearm through the federal check system. And Beto O'Rourke's running against guns in Texas, Michael, in fucking Texas. I mean,
so he doesn't
want to
be governor.
To fucking go down, and people are going to freeze in the dark in Texas. That's the issue.
Yeah.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, we see this over and over again. They'll pick an issue that they think is going to be the secret sauce of everything. And look, I think what's happening with abortion right now in this country is going to blow this country up in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's not going to save the Democrats in 2020. Everybody that was going to vote based on abortion, but on the end of Roe, is already in their pocket.
Yeah.
Is already a committed voter. Yeah. They've got to find things that people are actually finding relevant and meaningful in their lives,
like cutting the grocery tax in the state of Virginia.
Yeah, right. It's like this inflation that we're experiencing, that's a real thing.
Yeah,
it's a real. I mean, we did a lot of studies back in 2006 in the because we were like, why are we losing the fucking house? What's going on? What, we thought we were in good shape.
Yep.
And we went to school on it, and it was people pissed off that gas was $3.25 a gallon. That was a big driver because people saw that in their daily life.
Yeah.
It increased their decreased their ability to have a quality of life. And so, you know, there are things in this world that are happening to people. Why are so many people pissed off and upset about the economy? In part because they finally reached their fucking boiling point. They're like, okay, this company I'm working for is making billions of dollars a year. The CEO is making $300 million a year, and I can't get a raise from $11.45 an hour to $14 an hour, much less, you know, and people are pissed. There's enough opportunity out there in the economy to go and find something else, and they're doing it. These disruptions reflect a different social climate, and that climate is what affects elections.
So why are Democrats so tone deaf to what you just said? Because I'm sitting here, and as a political operative, former chairman, guy who, you know, knows how to win a few races and lost a lot.
Here and there, yeah.
Right, you know. I'm sitting there going, dude, this man, if anybody's listening, has just written a 30-second ad in the 30 seconds it took him to say what he said. Why don't the Democrats understand fundamentally where the American people are foundationally? Because that doesn't change.
They don't like a lot of them. Honest answer.
Really?
They really are. And I deal with this a lot. There are a lot of people, and it's the cliche that happens to be true. There are a lot of Democrats who believe that anybody that doesn't live in a coastal metropolitan area is a rube,
is a
chump, is a moron.
Yep.
And there are a lot of people that don't live in coastal metropolitan areas who are rubes and chumps and morons, but there are also a lot of rubes and chumps and morons in coastal metropolitan areas.
That's right.
It's just a different kind of rubism. And middle America was a ripe target for the Bannon, you know, Trump social alienation political campaign style. They've been told for years they're inferior, that they're not as good, that they're stupid, that they're not educated, that they're not sophisticated. And while that is true in many, many cases, when you've got the main party leadership treating them that way, it hurts them dramatically. The other thing that's happened out there in the world is they forgot how to win because they forgot how to win. They went into these states for years and they took African-American voters for granted.
Yeah.
They took Hispanic voters for granted. They took women voters for granted.
Yep.
And they said, they're with us. Fuck everybody else. Where are they going to go? Well, what do we see with Hispanic voters and Trump? Hispanic males broke for Trump in a dramatic way.
Black men
did too. If the Democrats don't see a giant fucking alarm bell ringing over that, they're idiots. But you know what they'd rather fucking do? They'd rather litigate over whether to call them Hispanic or Latinx.
I know.
It's the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard.
I know. They're like, why
can't we win in the Rio Grande Valley with Hispanic Democrats? Well, let's think. They're evangelical Christians and they don't like abortion. So you talk to them the same way you talk to Democratic voters in Austin, Houston, and Dallas. Really? Is that how it works? Because I don't think that's how anything works.
You make me laugh because it reminds me of when I was county chairman here in Prince George's County. And this actually during a Republican election in 1996, I believe, for that congressional race. I had a candidate, a Republican candidate, but it really goes to the broader point that you're making about Democrats, and it's true across the lines. He was went into a town hall meeting and he gave a speech and he laid out to this audience, hardcore, not hard, ugly core, but hardcore, right. True Republican foundational,
yeah, straight up.
Conservative, straight up ideas, around lower taxes and, better education. And then he launched into, I said, when I become a congressman, I'm going to go in and I want to go in and I want to cut the size of government. I want to reduce, government in your life. And at the end of the town hall, I went up to him. I said, that was pretty interesting. So what'd you think? He said, I thought it was great. I said, really? I said, who are you talking to? He said,
in PG County.
I said, yeah. So who are you talking to? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you're in Prince George's County, a county that's 80% African-American with a federal workforce of about 60%. And you just told
and that has generated enormous prosperity for the African-American community.
Right, right. So you just told all the federal workers, these black women in here, you just told all of them, hire me as your congressman so I can fire you.
Right.
So it matters, folks, how you have these conversations with voters. And it starts by listening to them because they will always tell you, Rick, this, voters will always tell you what they want, what they feel, what they don't like. Always. They just can't help it. Always. They're going to do it. It is amazing to me that Democrats never seem to hear that, particularly in the middle of the country, which I think when you talk about, if you want to revitalize the union community, if you want to get closer to real workers, you would begin by listening to what they're saying in places like Michigan and in places like, Ohio, et cetera, Pennsylvania, and understanding what they're saying. You're not going to lead with, here's my 17-point plan on the environment. You would lead with, here's my one good idea that I learned from you to help your husband, your wife, your kids get back to work, grow their economies, et cetera.
And it is. There is a consistency to great candidates, and great candidates are great listeners.
Yes.
And they are able to reflect back what they hear, what they understand, what they've been told. Those people who connect with voters. And this is another thing that the Democrats at the presidential level in the last 30 years were very, very, very spoiled by two candidates, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, two of the greatest natural politicians you and I have ever encountered.
Yeah.
Okay. Two of the people that could sit in a room and connect with people at a level that is almost supernatural. And when they don't pull an ace out of the deck like a Barack Obama or a Bill Clinton, they have a lot harder time having people come out and win races. One of the foundational moments of the Lincoln Project for me was in the debates in 2019 and early 2020. And Elizabeth Warren was ahead. She was the front runner. Mm-hmm. Biden was flailing. Buttigieg was sort of petering out. And she came out of a debate and she goes, well, we just had a great debate about policy. We didn't mention Donald Trump one time. even though that was the only issue in the minds of the voters, the only thing they were thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this recognition of what really counts in the electoral right. space every day, what's really happening. You know, to go back and one more philosophy thing, Immanuel Kant one time said there are two things in the universe. There's the phenomenon, which is the unreal thing that you can see. And then you can't understand it all the time, but you can see. And the noumenon, which is the real thing that you can't see. And the noumenon of politics, the real thing that people can't see, is that it's almost never about a set of ideas. It's about right. a set of principles and that's policies and leadership
that's right.
that are not in a book somewhere. They are in a person who starts out in a small room, shaking hands and connecting with people, mm-hmm. and they tell a friend, and they tell somebody else that shares on social media, and it spreads and it iterates out, and they become something representative and resonant to voters. And if you don't have that as a party, you know, this is why the Democrats are having a little bit of agita right now. They're like, oh, fuck, if Joe Biden doesn't run, who's on deck?
Right.
And they're going to have a civil war inside the party.
Yep.
Where the AOC wing and the Ilhan Omar wing is going to insist on their version of progressivism.
Yep.
And the practical politics wing, the Biden wing, the Obama wing, the Clinton wing, they're going to insist on their version, and nobody's going to be happy. And one group or the other is going to stay home.
Yep.
And it's in part because they have relied on the stunt casting of superstar candidates.
Yep.
And Biden was less of a rock star candidate than a lock picker. He's able to go and say, all right, I don't scare people. I'm not,
that's right.
I don't have a reputation as being a guy who is so far out there that I'm unelectable. Whereas Trump scared people. He scared a lot of people. He scared 80 million Americans enough to vote against him.
How does that set up then 2024? Let's say this scenario plays out as you've aptly described. Trump, looking at this now, is thinking to himself, well, shit, maybe this run for round two will be worth it because of how you just described the setup for 2024. Because even if Biden decides to run, I mean, what? I don't put a lot of credence in poll. I don't put any credence in a poll that I see today on a race that's in 2024, for God's sake. But I mean, right now, the general sentiment is Biden by 46, Trump by 45. And this is what, after what everybody knows about Donald Trump, you still have 45% of the people go, yeah, I'll take him over Biden.
Yeah, it is a sign of how deeply divided our politics has become. And there are only a limited number of states now where there are competitive congressional seats.
Yep.
There are only a limited number of states where you have competitive governor's races, where there's like a legitimate chance of crossover. And in those states, ironically, a lot of them have Republican governors right now, Maryland, Vermont, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And the idea that you could have those pre-Trumpian Republicans, it shows the viability of the conservative governance model still in those states, even though the rest of the party has gone so far into the wilderness, they couldn't get back with a GPS, a compass, and a trusty guide.
You know? Right,
it's
just, right.
It's a real weird space in terms of there are some weirdly bright lights out there that in a normal circumstance would be the Republican front runners, and on the Democratic side, they don't have governors and senators right now who are in that position to be, you know, the obvious choice that don't have a set of deficits.
Who do you see some of those bright lights on the Republican side?
Well, I think Phil Scott, Vermont.
Yeah.
I think Charlie Baker, although he's not going to run again, he was a guy who really went to work. I think Larry Hogan in Maryland, you know, and what's the difference in all these guys? They give a shit about the work.
Yeah.
They're not out trolling every day. They're not out like seeing how they can get, you know, social media to flame, getting a flame war every day. They're out like, hey, I got to get these potholes filled. hey, I got to get these people vaccinated. And it's weird because in Florida, there was a moment after he was elected where Ron DeSantis was definitely going to, you know, not go into the Trump swamp.
Yeah.
He was telling a lot of people, yeah, me included.
Yeah.
His people were like, hey, just stand by. Watch what's going to happen. It's not going to be Trump land.
Yeah.
And since he got talked into running for president, now he is like way out there. So
because all of this is a fertile playground for what you do so damn well. I still get compliments from the Lincoln Project effort with my endorsement video.
It's one of my favorite ads of the year because you absolutely just nailed it from the gut and the heart,
quintessential Lincoln Project. It touched the nerve in the right way. The script captured the moment. It felt American. It felt Maryland in a specific way. How are you guys positioning the project for this new terrain, which, as I've heard you warn, 2020 was a warm-up for what 2022 is going to be, and 2024, oh my God, right? So how are you guys planning to play?
Well, in 2022, we've got to do two big things. First off, we've got to keep control of at least the House or the Senate, because if it's a Republican sweep, that it's the apocalypse.
Yeah.
You will see, you know, the Lincoln Project, it will be up for congressional hearings as witnesses, not for fun.
You're right.
They will exercise power in a way that the Democrats will be shocked and awed and dismayed and sad and freaked out by, and it won't stop them. Because there is no shame.
And if it's close for them in the Senate with a majority in the Republican hand, they will eliminate the filibuster, just for the record.
Oh, in a hot minute. Mitch McConnell will dump the filibuster like a dead girlfriend in the trunk of his car. I mean, I'm not saying Mitch McConnell's a serial killer. I'm just saying he's a killer. But if they recapture the House and the Senate, we're in big trouble.
Yeah.
So we're going to focus on some targeted House races, probably about 15 of those that we think are important and we think are winnable, and where we think that the redistricting is going to be favorable enough where we can
offset
help some of the natural gains they got by this growth in the Sun Belt.
Right.
On the Senate side, actually, we know it's a hard map, but we're optimistic now that the hard map is resolving a little better.
Mm-hmm.
We think Ohio is moving out of Republican hands.
I agree.
That out of the race. You know, you got J.D. Vance and Josh Mandel, two of the people who are the most they're like people who are like, Ted Cruz is like, no, you're not cool enough to sit at my table in the lunchroom when Ted Cruz sits all by himself.
Right.
I mean, they're like horrible people, shitty, shitty, horrible people. And you know, Ted Cruz is not exactly like,
it's like, dude, you're at the table by yourself.
Right, right. Even he doesn't want those people. And Tim Ryan's a good candidate. You know, you've got Dr. Oz and the mutant parade in Pennsylvania coming together. That's going to be a shit show for the Republicans. And so we're looking at those two Senate seats, which are going to be consequential and grotesquely expensive, because God forbid. And folks don't know this, but if you do a race in Pennsylvania, you get fucked so hard if you try to be on television, because parts of it have to be in Philadelphia media market, parts are in the Baltimore media market, parts are in the New York media market. It's a goddamn nightmare.
That's right.
It's just hideously expensive. We're starting to think Georgia's looking a little better. We think Stacey Abrams getting in helps Reverend Warnock meaningfully in the Senate race.
Right.
And we think the Republican Civil War there, which we will be happy to encourage, is going to be a real shit show.
Would that race be for her in Georgia?
It's not going to be easy. But if the Kemp, if the three-way Republican gubernatorial primary turns into what we think it will, she's got a good shot.
Right.
And look, Stacey Abrams is popular among a lot of the voters. The Lincoln Project is good at targeting that 3 to 8% of suburban Republican leaners and independents who lean Republican but aren't locked in.
Right.
She's got a good chance with those folks. And she's got a real ability to raise money that I think will make her the most competitive Democratic governor candidate in the country.
I just did a program yeah. with our good friend, your partner, Stuart Stevenson, for Lincoln Project. We did.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He said you killed it.
Did a little round table with some of the supporters. And it was really funny. We were talking about this landscape and a lot of the supporters were, and I hear this a lot, Rick. A lot of people look at what you do at the Lincoln Project as certainly beyond Republican Party stuff, but certainly beyond even what Democrats are capable of doing. Does that kind of added pressure make it more challenging, or do you just like salivate over the opportunity to just kind of push politics to a different level? Or in a different way?
I want our politics in this country to be competitive. I want us to fight over big things. I don't want us to fight over whether we're going to have a republic any longer. Mm-hmm. Because there's an argument with a lot of people that they don't care. They just want to win. Yeah. They want to have control.
Right.
So the we do feel sometimes like, you know, we're some pretty lonely gunmen out there. Because there are people on the left who say, oh, don't worry, we've got this, even though they demonstrably do not have this.
Right. Because they don't know what this is.
Right. It's like, there's a reason we beat your ass like rented mules for 25 years. We're good at this shit.
Yeah.
Do we win every race? Of course not. Nobody does.
Right.
But we make a difference in critical spaces and critical times. And the critique of the Democratic Party from us comes from a place where we believe them to be allies in the small D democracy space. You know, I wish they were better at the work. And you know, we're talking to somebody the other day is affiliated with one of the big Democratic committees. And this person said to us, yeah, we're going to sit down in February and plan out our messaging for the year.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Okay. Yeah. We're going to lay the runway down while the plane is taxiing down it while we're trying to trap the wings on it.
That's right.
So, but look, the scope of the work ahead of us is enormous.
Yeah.
And, you know, as an organization, we have been through a hard year.
Yeah.
Because God knows, I wanted Donald Trump to go away. I wanted to be done with him. I wanted it to be a sharp shock to the GOP, so they had to reset. And I learned a hard lesson on January 6th of last year that these fucking guys, they will not stop.
Yeah.
They will not ever give up on trying to seize power in this country. And so, you know, my job now for the foreseeable future, I would much rather be restoring airplanes and flying around doing my thing and going bird hunting and whatever. Right. Reed wants to raise goats. He wants to move to Montana.
I don't know what it is with Reed and the goats. I don't know.
Reed loves the goats.
Reed loves the goats.
He knows he's a goat expert.
I don't understand.
Am I an expert on aircraft engines? Yes, I am. Is Reed an expert on goats? He is indeed.
Yes, he is.
But unfortunately, we don't get to take a breath yet.
Yeah,
because 22 is a big deal, and 22 decides 24.
It does.
I want folks to understand that in their gut. 22 decides 24. If it's Speaker Jim Jordan or Speaker Donald Trump, which is a possibility, nightmarish as that sounds, we are going to have a 2-year national nightmare where they burn down everything Biden tries to do. He will not get a single appointment. He will not get a single judge. He will be investigated. He will be impeached. It will be an endless, and there will be months of hearings on Hunter Biden's laptop.
Yep.
It will never stop.
Oh, and not to mention that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Gosar mm-hmm. and all the other miscreants will be not only put back on committees, but maybe have chairing committees.
When she tweeted that thing, oh, I just heard from the majority leader or from McCarthy, and it's all good now. I'm like, ladies and gentlemen, meet the new budget chairman.
That's it. That's it.
And, you know, hey, she's like, Ways and Means is open. Why can't I have that?
Yeah,
you know, yep. it's gonna be worse than people can possibly imagine, and God bless the liberal news media. They will cover it like they cover everything. Of one side says and the other side says, it's not that way anymore, folks.
It's not.
One side wants to throw democracy into a radioactive hellscape. One side may be fucked up and not do a good job campaigning, but at the end of the day, they're not trying to burn American democracy to the ground.
They're trying to govern. And so, and while, you know,
God bless their hearts.
You're right. They're trying to govern and they just can't figure it out yet, but that's okay. It's better than having conversations about, you know, overthrowing the government, or, you know, the president today announced that, you know, we're no longer going to be doing X, Y, and Z at election and polling right. places, et cetera. Those are going to be important discussions for people to understand. I think you put your finger on something I hope people don't lose sight of, Rick, and that is you think it was bad under Trump. Imagine what it will look like with a Speaker Jim Jordan,
yep,
a Majority Leader McConnell, and a President Trump.
Yep, and they will. And again, as you pointed out earlier, correctly,
that's the next 3 years.
Mitch McConnell will burn the filibuster to the ground the second he needs to, and they will sprint for the finish line of what I call the last election.
Yeah,
they will pass voting rights restrictions. They will pass their own personal flavors of redistricting. They will stack the playing field, where essentially it's going to look like the Ba'ath Party.
Yeah. You know,
Saddam Hussein always every 2 years got 105% of the vote.
Right. You
know? And his slate of candidates always won. You know, one guy from another party would sometimes like get close to winning, and then he would like be found dead in a ditch.
Right.
This will turn into the appearance of a democracy, the appearance of a republic, with all the bullshit peeled away. It's going to be an authoritarian state. And that's what keeps me up at night. That's what keeps me highly caffeinated. And I keep putting one foot in front of the other.
And that's why I love you, brother. You do that so well. He is Thank Rick you, Wilson. Friend. I appreciate you taking time, man. And
absolutely delighted as always, sir.
And keeping it real.
There's no such thing as halfway crooks in my world, my friend.
There you go. That's what I love about you, bro. All right, folks, that does it for this conversation. It's always a joy when you drop in and spend some time with us. Don't forget to check us out on Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts. Do the download thing. It makes me feel all yummy inside. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. Make sure you check out my man, Rick Wilson, at Rick Wilson, right?
Rick Wilson.
The Rick Wilson. That's
the
right.
The Rick Wilson. There's some other poor son of a bitch who had Rick Wilson before me who had to take his account private. I think he lives in witness protection now.
I bet he does. At the Rick Wilson on Twitter. Until next time, be safe, be well. Wear the damn masks, all right? Get the shots.
Wear the mask. Go get your boosters.
Thank you. Stop being assholes about it. You know what you need to do. Your mama told you now. Come on, let's
do it. The no asshole rule.
Later.
Right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news? weird politics, weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.